Today is the fourth day of our July-August 7-day session, 2nd of August 2017. And this morning we're going to look at working with the emotions. In Doksan this morning, it was very clear that this session had reached a new stage. People are starting to go deeper, and this comes out in lots of different ways. For some people, who are working on koans, is the sense of being stymied, of getting to a point where seems to be no going forward, no going back. A kind of of one's options having run out. And it's just this sense of perplexity. For others, it is hitting turbulent emotional waters. Just to switch metaphors, when I came out of Doksan this morning, I felt like this little spaceship of Sesshin had suddenly encountered an asteroid belt. We were trying to dodge all these big bits of rock hurtling towards us. And they come in many forms. Bouts of fear, anxiety, strong self-doubt, even self-sabotage. One teacher calls this inner voice, he labels it the inner tyrant. This authority, this withering voice inside us that can undermine all our sincere efforts. Whatever we do, this inner voice is cynical about it and can press us on all our most painful points. Or another one coming up for some people is a sense of being alienated, being on the outside looking in, imagining that everyone else is engaged in their practice, but I'm 10,000 miles away from that. Others just experience a sense of resistance to the practice. Completely involuntary sense of holding back, even though at the same time wanting to engage, wanting to become one with the practice. Or it can be very, very painful memories coming up, accompanied by a lot of regret. Past action. Another one is anger, from ranging from sort of simmering resentment up to rage. The first thing to remind ourselves of here is. Not to make the mistake of thinking we shouldn't be going through these emotional states. They are part of being human. Great Master Zhao Zhou said once, "Buddhahood is passion. And passion is Buddhahood." And a monk came and asked him in response to this, "In whom does Buddha cause passion?" And Joshi replied, "Buddha causes passion in all of us." And then the monk asked, "How do we get rid of it?" And Joshi replied, "Why should we get rid of it?" So I'd like to approach this topic in two slightly different ways. First, to look at what the classic response might be to how we work with these emotions when they arise. And for this, we're going to look at a little passage from Tracing Back the Radiance, Chinul's Korean Way of Zen, translated by Robert E. Buswell Jr. And actually, it's mostly not going to be Chinul's words. Some of it will be, but the majority of what we're going to read is actually Chinul quoting Da Hui, who's, of course, we mentioned the other day, the great champion of koan practice. His dates are 1089 to 1163. So, if we were just as koan practitioners to say how do we work with emotional turmoil, there's no better person that we could turn to than to Da Hui. And starting with Da Hui, we're going to then go in a different direction. So Da Hui said, and this is Chinul quoting him, If you want to understand the principle of the shortcut, you must blanket the one thought and suddenly break through it. Then and only then will you comprehend birth and death." So Da Hui actually calls koan work the shortcut. The shortcut. Is it any wonder that we want to do koan? It's because we can take the shortcut. He hooked us with that one. He says, "You must blanket the one thought and suddenly break through it. Then and only then will you comprehend birth and death." And of course, the one thought is the question. It's the koan, the what, or the who, or the mu. So he's saying, just put all your energies into the questioning. This is called the axis of awakening. You should not retain any thought which waits for that breakthrough to occur, however. So to completely become absorbed in the question means there's no room for waiting for the breakthrough to occur. We already talked about this yesterday. He says, if you retain a thought which simply waits for a breakthrough, then you will never break through for an eternity of kalpas. You need only to lay down all at once the mind full of deluded thoughts and inverted thinking, the mind of logical discrimination, the mind which loves life and hates death, the mind of knowledge and views, interpretation and comprehension, and the mind that rejoices in stillness and turns from disturbance. Only when you have laid down everything should you look into the following Hua Do. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, does a dog have the Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou replied, moo. So he's holding fast to the steep way here. So to lay down everything, even the mind of sorrow, the mind of anxiety, and although it may seem like an impossible thing, it is possible to go from a mind of sorrow and anxiety to a mind of awakening. Think of the example of Eckhart Tolle, who had his enlightenment experience from being in a state of suicidal depression. Dao Hui then goes on to enumerate 8 wrong ways of approaching the koan. 8 mistakes we can make. He says this one word is the weapon which smashes all types of wrong knowledge and wrong conceptualization. Then he goes through these 8 ways we can of wrong knowledge and wrong conceptualization. You should not understand it to mean yes or no. This is referring to mu. 2, you should not consider it in relation to doctrinal theory, so you shouldn't try and interpret the koan according to what you know about Buddhist theory. 3, you should not ponder over it logically at the consciousness base. And I think this really just means trying to reason it out. Consciousness base probably means from a discriminating intellect. 4, when the master raises his eyebrows or twinkles his eyes, you should not think he is giving instructions about the meaning of the Hua Do. So don't go to Dogsan looking to get hint, or then interpreting what happens this way or that way after you leave. Five, you should not make stratagems for solving the Hua Do through the use of speech. I think of where he says not make stratagems can be tempting to, when you're sitting in the Dogsan line, to rehearse what you're going to say or what you're going to do when you get in the room, rather than just staying with the koan and then seeing what happens when you get inside the room. You should not busy yourself inside the tent of unconcern. And I think that's pretty obvious. But there's a footnote connecting it to just doing dead sitting rather than really engaging with the practice. Just getting into a calm place, but not really, really investigating. 7, you should not consider it at the place where you raise the Hua Do to your attention. There's a footnote about this. It's a little bit complicated. But it's basically saying that one should inquire into the actual Hua Do rather than inquiring into the nature of the mind in terms of how your mind apprehends sense objects. And then 8, you should not look for evidence in the wording. Throughout the 12 periods and the 4 postures, try always to keep the question raised before you and centered in your attention. Does a dog have the Buddha nature or not? He said, moo. without neglecting your daily activities, try to work in this manner. And then Chinnell adds, I, Moguja, said, and Moguja was what he called himself, it means ox herder. I, Moguja, said, this Dharma discourse only delineated 8 defects. If we examine its exposition from beginning to end, however, we must also include these 2 defects. 9, taking it to be the moo of true non-existence, and 10, grasping at a deluded state, simply waiting for awakening. Consequently, together they amount to 10 defects. So taking it to be the moo of true non-existence is taking moo to have some kind of philosophical meaning from our Buddhist point of view. And then grasping at a deluded state, simply waiting for awakening, not really questioning, just waiting for something to happen. I think here of the story of a hunter who witnessed a rabbit being chased by a predator. The rabbit collided with a tree stump and knocked itself out, and so the hunter got a meal. He took the rabbit and ate it. And then after that, he would sit by the tree stump waiting for a rabbit to come to collide into it for his dinner. He didn't get much to eat from that method. But I guess the point here with these instructions from Da Wei is that they're really... they're not instructions. If anything, they're taking away stratagems from us. And really, that's the point with working on a koan is this emptying out of all the ways that we normally maneuver. He goes back and quotes Da Hui again. Zhao Zhou's Huadu, the dog, has no Buddha nature, Mu, must be kept raised before you, regardless of whether you are joyful or angry, calm or disturbed. It is of prime importance not to set your mind on expecting an awakening. If you do, you are saying to yourself, I am deluded now. If you grasp at a delusion and wait for awakening, then even though you will pass through kalpas as numerous as dust motes, you will never achieve it. When you raise the wado, you must put your spirits in good order and inquire, what is the meaning of this? There's a lot in this short paragraph. So in relating to our topic of working with emotions, Da Wei says, just keep the koan raised before you, regardless of whether you are joyful or angry, calm or disturbed. That's the classic instruction. Then he goes on to say it's of prime importance for you not to set your mind on expecting an awakening. If you do, you're saying to yourself, I am deluded now. A very important point. And it's one that many people at a certain point realize is part of the engine of their efforts in the practice, is realizing that they are thinking that to myself, I'm deluded now, and I want to be awakened some point in the future. But there's grasping in that. That's the problem. And as long as there's grasping, we're stuck in samsaric existence. Then Chinnell finishes up. He says, although the discussion to this point has been given in accordance with the faculties of the readers, the meaning lies beyond the ken of logical operation of the mind and consciousness. This is really what Da Wei is doing. He's taking away our attempts, robbing us of our usual way of working, using the mind and consciousness, logic and logic. It will enable people to remove the nails and pull out the pegs and to free themselves from the bridle and the yoke. And in the footnote it says that there's to grasp at self or dharmas is like nails and pegs. To stagnate in intellectual knowledge and conceptual interpretation is like a bridle or a yoke. So get past these fetters is the promise of the practice. If you can attend carefully to your investigation, you will be able to cleanse away the preceding defects of conceptual understanding concerning the Buddha Dharma. Then you will reach the ultimate stage of peace and happiness. And of course that's what we all want, isn't it? To reach some degree of peace and happiness. That is the promise of the practice, isn't it? And then Channel says something which takes us in a different direction. He says, you must know that people who are cultivating the path in this present degenerate age of the Dharma should first, via conceptual understanding which accords with reality, discern clearly the mind's true and false aspects, its arising and ceasing, and its essential and secondary features. Next, through a word that splits nails and cuts through iron, you should probe closely and carefully. So that second part is referring to working with a koan. Through a word which splits nails and cuts through iron, you should probe closely and carefully. But he's saying, before you get to that, before you do that, it may be helpful in this degenerate age of the Dharma, which just means for those of us with not such sharp Dharma roots. This degenerate age was something that came from a Buddha where he designated four different ages after his teaching, and from about, I guess about the 10th century, people in Buddhism felt that they were in that fourth age of the degenerate age, when the Dharma was less practiced and understood by people. So Channel seems to be saying, well, in this degenerate age, it could be good to work actually with the conceptual mind, with our conceptual understanding, and look into the mind using that. Discern clearly the mind's true and false aspects, its arising and ceasing, and its essential and secondary features. So, I think we can take this to mean that there are other ways of working with emotions besides how we do it when we use a koan. And he's probably referring here to contemplation of Buddhist psychology, the Abhidharma, taking up the teachings of the Abhidharma and exploring them in a contemplative fashion, so that one understands, so one's got this background of understanding of how our minds work, or what he calls here the mind's true and false aspects, its arising and ceasing, and its essential and secondary features. So there may be times when working in other ways, not using the koan, might be more helpful. And it would be quite wrong to think of the koan is just some kind of magic bullet that will solve all our problems. Ken Wilber talked of there being two distinct kind of tracks that we need to walk together, really, which he called waking up and growing up. And we can walk the path of waking up and neglect some aspects of growing up. Growing up has to do with our emotional life, our relationship to work, to other beings of the opposite sex, how we operate in the world, and of course waking up is more to do with transcendence. That we're really separating them in. They can't be separated completely, but we can distinguish between these two paths. They inform each other, but they are different. So, for this second half of the Taisho, we're going to just explore a little bit what it might look like to work with the emotions, where there is a conceptual element, and just to go in this direction, we're going to read a chapter from a book called The Wisdom of Imperfection, The Challenge of Individuation in Buddhist Life. This is by Rob Preece, who is both a psychologist and a Vajrayana practitioner of many years and a teacher. Lived in Nepal for many years, is British. And his chapter is called Working with the Emotions. And he starts off by pointing out that our relationship to our feelings and emotions is critically important, and colour the whole of our lives. He says, when we are unable to cope with our feelings and emotions, our lives can be an unbearable struggle. The fundamental experience of suffering, emphasized so much in Buddhist philosophy, can be seen as being largely determined by our capacity to deal with this feeling aspect of life. While the problems and challenges our lives throw at us give rise to painful emotional responses, the crucial factor is not how to change the world, but how to change our minds. If we have clarity and spaciousness in the mind, the pain and stresses of life do not cause the same level of suffering. So this is a first point here, and it's an aspect that all the different practices address, just bringing a greater clarity and spaciousness to our minds and slowing things down enough so that we can begin to see the way in which they unfold. All the practices will help with this. When we learn to respond more healthily to the emotions and feelings that arise, we can radically change the quality of our lives. One of the greatest disappointments I felt in growing up was that no one ever gave me help in dealing with emotions. The experience must be extremely widespread, because as a psychotherapist, possibly the main aspect of my work is helping people discover how to live with their feelings. No doubt, much of what attracts me to Buddhist psychology and meditation is the attention given to working with the emotions. The different Buddhist traditions may approach emotions in subtly different ways, but their management or transformation remains a priority. And then he talks about how in the management of his own emotional life, he would try to bring together these two threads of his own background, one being a psychotherapist and the other a meditator. And he says that when he first became a therapist, he was very conscious of the difference in the two styles of dealing with the emotional life. That psychotherapy was coming from the angle of looking into the origins of our emotional habits, talking them through, had a developmental aspect to it. Whereas Buddhism, it was more to do with looking at the emotions as they arose, and in order to achieve a state of quiescence. And he says that over time his understanding of both deepened and became more subtle, so that he saw that these two approaches, how well they can complement and inform each other. He labels them the reflective and the contemplative approaches. And he goes on to say, this exploration has, however, highlighted a particular concern, namely the potential for those who develop meditation practices to use them as a means to avoid feelings rather than to transform them. Wellwood aptly calls this type of avoidance spiritual bypassing. And I think it's fair to say that that koan work is particularly prone to being misused in this way because of its emphasis on just blasting through everything with the question. And what can happen is that rather than breaking our identification with the painful emotions and letting them go, we're just really pressing them down, suppressing them, pushing them away so that we don't have to experience them. So when we're in a find we're caught up in very powerful emotions, it may be more beneficial to take up a breath or shikantaza while working through that rather than doing the koan work and coming back to that when there's some greater insight has been had around whatever the emotion is. And we'll get into some more specific examples soon. He says, when spiritual practice is genuinely integrated in daily life, this is reflected in how we are moment by moment and day by day with our feelings and emotions. Some who claim to have a great experience of meditation may still display strong emotional problems. Others equally experienced in meditation show signs of having repressed their capacity for feeling and emotions in quite unhealthy ways. The question then arises as to whether someone who is developing deep insights in meditation should be free of emotions and emotional reactions. Well, the teaching is that you can have an insight into emptiness, but still have unfinished business, still have emotional issues that need to be resolved and worked through, because these things come out of deep conditioning. Maybe a very deep kensho might clear up some of that stuff, but most are not. We enter into some understanding with a relatively shallow experience. He goes on, I have often been amused by people who say, when I honestly express how I have emotionally reacted to something, but you're a Buddhist, you shouldn't have any emotional problems. And we may laugh at that, but then we also can have that own idea in our own heads and feel like we're a failed Buddhist because we get angry or lustful. Evidently, they think that Buddhist meditation practice is supposed to eliminate feelings and emotions. My answer to this is that the intention of Buddhist practice is not to become emotionally sterile, but to have the capacity to respond to emotions in a healthy way. In this respect, once again, it is not the fact that we have feeling or emotional responses to the world that is the problem, but exactly how we are with them. When an emotion arises, we can respond to it in a number of ways. We can become completely absorbed in it, or, to use the psychological language, identified with it, so that all we feel is the overwhelming power of the emotion. He goes on to talk about what happens when you're in totally identified with the emotion, that it can become really unbearable, and it can mean that we do things that we regret later. We can strike out in some way, say things we regret, this sort of thing. Now, this doesn't happen so much in Sesshin because we're not relating to others, so it can more just be like a sort of volcano in our own hearts and minds, where we just get completely caught up in proliferating passion, and with not any space to become aware of the process that is unfolding, because we've become lost in it. So if you're doing the breath or Shukantaza, one of the things that can happen is we can create some space so that we don't totally identify with whatever's coming up. He says, if we could slow the process down, we might see that this emotion began as a relatively subtle feeling that grew as we intensified our contraction around and into the feeling. Eventually, it became the full-blown emotional response. Goes on to say, I'm reminded of the time when I was in retreat in the Himalayas in India. I would spend each monsoon season high up in the mountains, with a staggeringly spectacular view of the sky in all its moods. I would often sit outside my stone hut, looking out toward the plains below. Suddenly, within the intense blue sky, I would see the emergence of a speck of white cloud. It would wisp around in the air currents and gradually grow. Within the space of perhaps an hour, I could watch before me the germination and growth of what was gradually becoming a powerful cumulus cloud. As it grew and billowed up into the stratosphere, I would begin to see its dark core of a critical tension of forces. Flashes would begin to manifest from this core. Rumbles of thunder could be heard as the tension grew to the point where something had to break. Suddenly I would see below the cloud an immense downpour falling out of the heart of this dark mass. Having spent many years in India, I knew only too well what it was like to be in that drenching storm. The volume of water that gathers in these cumulus clouds, only to fall in such a short time, is truly a natural wonder. From my vantage point, I could watch the guts of the clouds spill into the land below, emptying and releasing the tension. The heart of the cloud would collapse, expended and discharged. The natural forces would slowly diminish, having released their energy, and the conditions that supported the white cloud would dissipate. The cloud slowly shrank to a mere wisp again, slowly circulating in the currents. Finally, the last vestiges would vanish and the sky would be pristine blue once more. And he goes on to reflect on how moving and shifting of clouds was very much like the nature of our mind and our emotions. and that it's only when we can slow our inner processes down that we can even discern the beginnings of some emotional storm. Usually it hits us when it's already developed to quite a strong degree. So part of practice is being able to catch our emotions when they're still at this more subtle stage. And an essential element, and really the process of understanding, is to have a felt sense of what is going on. And that it means feeling the emotion in our body-mind. But we can't get to that point of examining what's going on in the body unless we have used our discriminating mind to actually identify that there is a feeling there, and so with a little bit of space between us and the feeling. So he goes on to talk about how important to loosen this identification is acknowledging what is going on and identifying the energies that rise in us. He talks about strategy is to get to know the different voices that arise in our minds and give them names. He calls them subpersonalities of the emotional state. And he gives some examples of when we're tyrannical or angry or hurt, then to give these voices a name: the tyrant, the three-year-old orphan, the stern father. This is the first step. I think of a piece of advice that Master Sheng Yin would give about working with our small self, and it's painful manifestations. He would say, face it, accept it, deal with it, let it go. So the face it, give it a face, look it in the face. Ah, that's you in a tyrant. And then you've got a little bit more choice. Do you listen to that inner tyrant who says, this is waste of your time, you can't do this, what arrogance to think that you can do spiritual practice. So all of that, you can say, okay, inner tyrant, I'm not going to listen to you. These methods can enable us to step outside the intensity of the emotional turmoil so that we are not taken over. It may be that in doing this for the first time in our lives, this identification process, we actually feel as though we can be relatively stable and yet still feel the emotions. So often when people speak of their emotions, they describe how they feel utterly powerless to do anything about them. They feel out of control and dominated by the force of the emotional eruptions. Disidentification when emotions occur suddenly brings a sense of still being in control. And this does not mean controlling the emotions, even with the presence of powerful feelings. In the therapeutic setting, it is often after many months of struggle that suddenly a client will say, "It happened again the other day, but this time I did not get lost in it." The sense of relief and renewal of self-trust is immense. So this is, we're not talking here about controlling our emotions, but about getting some sense of control over our reactions to them. And this word here is a very important one to understand and remember when dealing with turbulent emotions. Disidentification. Disidentification is the first step towards what in the meditation world leads to an altogether new possibility. Meditation actually strengthens this capacity to disidentify as the witness awareness becomes more acute. Disidentification is very difficult if everything happens too fast. Before we know it, we've been taken over once again. What meditation facilitates, if it is practiced skillfully, is the capacity to watch feelings and emotions arising from a conscious and increasingly subtle place. By holding the mind's awareness in a clear, relatively thought-free state, it is possible to be mindful of the arising of feelings and emotions with greater and greater skill, just as the author here watched from the mountain the arising of clouds below him. The mind is not easy to tame, and as a consequence will be easily blown around by whatever thoughts, images and feelings arise, as well as by sounds and other sensory influences from around us. As we learn to settle the mind into a relatively quiet state, witnessing what is passing through its field of awareness becomes more and more possible. We will begin to notice the little clouds before they become huge storms. If we can cultivate a disposition that is not sticky, that is to say, does not get caught up in passing experiences, then witnessing them becomes more stable. From a meditation point of view, the most powerful capacity of mind that can relate to the emotions and feelings in a fresh way is one that is clear, non-judging, open and spacious. That is, clear of the sense of being free of the conceptual clutter that Tibetans call namtok, that worries and fantasizes around emotions, making them even more solid and fixed. Spacious in that the mind does not contract around and try to interfere with our feelings so as to do something to make them go away. This is a state of complete acceptance of what is arising. So this is the second time. First we give a face to what is going on, and then just to accept it's what is arising. It doesn't mean we're this kind of person or that kind of person. Our emotions arise out of causes and conditions. Goes on to talk about Mahamudra practice, in which the meditator settles into a clear, spacious quality of presence awareness. And this is really akin, this practice is akin to Shikantaza, in which feelings and emotions are allowed to arise and pass without interference. He says, when we do not interfere by contracting around them or pushing them away, the energy of these feelings can pass through without so much disturbance. We may feel them intensely, but they pass through rather than becoming stuck. It is not the strength of emotions or feelings that is the issue, but whether we are simply remaining open and allowing them to go where they need to go. This does not mean acting them out or even discharging them. It is more the capacity to remain fully in the body, aware of the arising of the feelings and allowing them to move through without obstruction. the underlying energy of these emotions can then become an extraordinary invigoration of vitality that rushes through our nervous system but is not obstructed in its flow. And also, if we can get to be able to completely face and accept our emotions of all kinds, of all stripes, then we'll be able to be there for others as well. Without having gone through this process, how can we really develop true compassion, true empathy? How can we really relate to others with loving kindness? Unless we have accepted our own emotional landscape with all its shadows and difficulties and obstructions. Goes on to talk about another stage, which is being able to transform the energy of the emotions, and really this is where it gets into this whole thing of experiencing our own emotions in order to develop greater compassion and loving kindness. We haven't got time to go into this in detail, but just to finish up. He quotes the great Buddhist teacher Shantideva, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. He says, likewise, it is not possible for me to restrain the external course of things, but should I restrain this mind of mine, what would be the need to restrain all else? The strong emotions that emerge in the mind can completely colour our experience of life. We can be in a beautiful forest, but unable to experience that forest because we're so gripped by an emotion. So this learning to hold emotions in a skillful way is essential. He concludes, one of the practices of the Bodhisattva is to transform adverse circumstances into the path. In other words, we can be grateful when adverse circumstances arise because they give us practice at this basic activity of the Bodhisattva. We can learn not to wallow, but to just hold, to be aware, to bring both a kind of cool intelligence and a compassionate heart to what is going on within and around us in terms of the emotional atmosphere. Finally, a short passage from Master Hongzhi. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine, this is how to strike down and fold up the remaining habits of many lives. When the stains from old habits are exhausted, the original light appears, blazing through your skull, not admitting any other matters. Vast and spacious, like sky and water merging during autumn, like snow and moon having the same color, this field is without boundary, beyond direction, magnificently one entity without edge or seam. Further, when you turn within and drop off everything completely, realization occurs. Right at the time of entirely dropping off, deliberation and discussion are 1,000 or 10,000 miles away. Still, no principle is discernible. So what could there be to point to or explain? People with the bottom of the bucket fallen out immediately find total trust. So we are told simply to realize mutual response and explore mutual response. Then turn around and enter the world. Roam and play in samadhi. Every detail clearly appears before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow, happen instantly without leaving traces. The outside and myself do not dominate each other, only because no perceiving of objects comes between us. Only this non-perceiving encloses the empty space of the Dharma realm's majestic 10,000 forms. People with the original face should act and fully investigate the field without neglecting a single fragment. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the gateway of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow.